Hello, here we are with Lisa Garforth. Lisa, thank you so much for agreeing to do this interview today with us for the journal. It's great to have you. Do you want to introduce yourself shortly?
I'm Lisa Garforth. I lecture in sociology at Newcastle University in the UK. And sociology is not historically been rich with utopian theory and thought, I don't think, apart from the huge exception of Ruth Levitas's work. So I kind of practice thinking about utopianism and green utopianism from the point of view of trying to understand how the formal discipline of sociology and more broadly societies are able to imagine alternative greener futures. And I use a lot of fiction in that process. So I usually describe myself as a kind of cultural sociologist, sometimes a social theorist with a particular interest in green futures. But I think in a more utopian sympathetic setting, I would tend to say that, I've worked in the broad context of utopian studies most of my academic life, which has given me quite a wide range of resources, tools, concepts, fictions, people, like really nice networks and supportive conversations that have helped me understand creatively how, in the discipline of sociology, we can put the future into the work we do on understanding the present, if that makes sense.
And how would you define utopian studies for somebody who's not acquainted with this kind of interdisciplinary field?
I mean, I think of it as a series of conversations and dialogues with a few kind of shared concepts and ideas at the heart of it, but that is very open to a lot of diversity. So I would say there's a thread of thinking in utopian studies that I mean, I think theoretically and conceptually, right, the work of Ernst Bloch remains at the heart of the enterprise of what we do. That's not to say that some version of utopian and utopian thinking doesn't predate Bloch. Of course it does, but I think that's the kind of those are the traditions of critical thinking that I understand to be kind of really close to the heart of utopian studies as a field that tries to understand utopia processually, so not as a thing, but not as an end point or a goal, but as something that is happening socially. It's a way of thinking, a way of dreaming, a way of hoping, that is quite ubiquitous, and that's really important to me, I think, as a sociologist. I think one of the things you discover when you engage with utopian studies as a field of study is, you could make some fairly obvious points about its interdisciplinarity, right? It's rich with people who work on fiction and literature, of course, because it's dreaming alternative societies often takes that textual and narrative form. It's rich with people who work in political philosophy, because so many debates about how we can imagine and interrogate a better future are rooted in either being invested in a specific political ideology, but those are certainly where the interesting discussions have happened, I think, historically. There's also loads of interesting people from planning and architecture and all those different faces of utopianism that Lamantau Sargent talks about, and more, geographers and sociologists and finance people and visual arts people and increasingly computer games people. That's really exciting. But I think, so you can just say it's interdisciplinary and people understand that. But for me, there's a bigger kind of theoretical and conceptual point about the openness of utopian studies as a field to find the traces of utopian desire in all those different forms of expressions, right? And that tells us something, or reminds us really of something that Bloch was really keen to insist on, which that utopianism is really ordinary. And I find that really encouraging and useful as a way of thinking, that it's not the special preserve of a novelist or a totalitarian planner, or it's not a special kind of activity. And I, when I teach utopianism to undergraduates, which I do in sociological context in the UK, which is quite unusual still, I think, I try to kind of kick off with I'm going to angle the quote now, but there's a great quote from Henri Lefebvre that kind of just says, we're all utopians the minute we kind of notice that the world is unfair or wrong in some way, and we start to even gesture towards the imagination of an alternative. So for me, the embedding of a kind of ordinary sort of utopianism in social life, that it belongs to all of us communally in some way, is and I, you know, I don't know how much of that is because of my discipline and how much of it is that I want to bring utopia into my discipline, but I see it as a deeply ordinary social thing. And I think utopian studies is where that perception comes from, I think.
Mm-hmm. And within utopian studies and within the different kinds of utopias we can talk about, I would like to ask you, how would you define ecotopias? Also,
we talked about this quite a lot recently, right?
I mean,
but it feels like an intuitive way of putting a label on green utopianism. Let me take a backtrack, right? So I wrote a book broadly about green utopianism a few years ago, and I explained in that book that I actually didn't use the term ecotopia very much. For two reasons. One was that I was trying in that novel to use the notion of green utopia, probably not very successfully, but it mattered to me at the time. Green utopianism couldn't be reduced to the utopias produced by specific ecocentric philosophies. Does that make sense?
Sorry, can you repeat?
Yeah, I think I need to go at that another time. I think when I was starting to think about these ideas in the late 90s and early 2000s, there had been a couple of bits of writing about ecological utopianism, mainly by political philosophers. And the political philosophers were quite keen to decide about what you could call an ecotopia in terms of the content of a philosophical vision, and to ally those visions quite tightly to specific named strands or branches of ecological philosophy. So eco-anarchism or radical ecology, you know, these are labels in the language of ecological philosophy that specify different traditions of thinking about non-human centered ways of imagining human well-being and human society. So the prefix eco to me seemed to carry quite a lot of potentially quite problematic weight, because it meant that you could only recognize visions of better, greener futures if they conform to some sort of ideological script on the one hand. And by the time I was writing the book, which was quite a lot later than I had these original thoughts, the very notion of a coherent, useful environmentalism or ecologism was becoming so problematized, particularly in cultural studies and environmental humanities, that I was a bit uncomfortable with the idea of the eco. Mm-hmm. Probably read a bit too much Timothy Martin at that point. And a lot of the work I was doing in my book was to do with what happens, how do you imagine better, greener futures when we don't anymore believe in a separate nature or an ecosystem as a self-defined, self-evident reality. So I've been a bit tentative about the notion of ecotopia. Oh, there's another reason for not using it as well, which is that there's a book called Ecotopia by Ernest Kallenbach. Mm-hmm. From 1971, did we decide? And we were talking about it before. I managed to write a PhD on green utopianism from the 1960s to the 1990s that didn't discuss that book.
Wow.
To say, I didn't really like it, and I didn't think it was interesting, and I didn't want to talk about it. I think it was an important like moment.
75, it's Ecotopia.
Thank you so much. It was a really important moment in post-war American environmentalism, that book. It's not a very good book. And if you're interested in kind of fictional visions of better futures, satisfying fictional visions of better futures, and also visions of better environmental futures that aren't problematic on gender. Yeah. It's not fantastically. I don't think it's a very good book. So that's where the word ecotopia comes from, to the best of my knowledge. I've not done a huge amount of research on it. But I think now, in the face of, you know, what feels like a much more pressing climate crisis and a much more public climate crisis, I think the word ecotopia is it's helpful now in a way that it perhaps wouldn't have been 10 or 15 years ago or 20 or 25 years ago. I think it's now kind of separated itself out from Kallenbach's novel. It's become a bit detached from some of those ecological philosophies which have lost salience, I think, in broader environmental debates in recent years, and we might want to talk about that or we might not. But it just doesn't go away, right, I think, in certain kinds of cultural discourse, the notion of ecotopia. So we need to make it useful and we need to work with it. So I would say on that basis, I would kind of be reasonably happy using it to mean something like an inclusive box or bucket in which we can put, broadly speaking, visions of a better world, a better society, and better ways of being for human and non-human kin that is rooted in a more sustainable, more respectful, more diverse and more lively vision of human non-human relationships than we currently are able to have because of the many, many anthropocentric and capital-centric social systems and racist and gendered social systems that we've built around not really understanding or caring really about what it might mean to live well with that wider non-human world. I think the phrase I've most often used to describe that is, I think about ecotopia as visions of how to live better with what we used to call nature. Mm-hmm. But I'm you know, I think it is increasingly hard. You can't, when I first started writing about this, you sort of used the word nature to deconstruct it. That was the point, right? But you had the kind of foreground what the topic was and what the object that we wanted to deconstruct was. But the debates around that have now moved so far that it's not helpful to keep reiterating this, you know, nature with a capital N, the nature that Cronon told us was not real, you know, the wilderness that was constructed, all those things. So it's good. I think that's good in a way that we've got past that point in cultural debates about it, and we can take ecotopia if we want to be a rallying point for like positive visions of a better future. And I think it can do that work. Yeah, so that's, I wouldn't define it in a hard and fast way, mm-hmm. but I would suggest that we could make it a useful signifier.
So you think we are past those debates on nature and...
Well, yes and no, because academically and intellectually, I think in the sort of areas of thinking about the culture and environment together that I work in, and I guess you work in to a certain extent, those are not battles that I feel we need to have anymore. But the kinds of thinkers that I've been most reliant on to help me understand the dismantling of that category of nature, I would say the kind of big three for me, especially when I was writing the book, were Latour and Haraway and Bennett, I think. But those thinkers are fantastically rigorous in refusing to let us work with that category of a kind of separate nature, but are also in some respects philosophical enough to feel comfortable with disattending to the fact that if you want to look at this empirically and socially and sociologically, most people have not finished with that category of nature, not at all, right? In public debates and popular discourse, it is as absolutely relentless as ever that there is a separate natural world that we have to care for. You know, all those kinds of arguments that we've become very skeptical of in the academy. And at one point, I think I sort of imagined the work I was doing going a bit more down the direction of what does it mean? What does it mean in public, in societies, in Western societies, in the global north, to hang on to this notion of nature? What might we be able to do with that? Is it still fulfilling an important function? Can it do some work politically? Mm-hmm. I haven't really done that work, but I do relentlessly wonder about, mm-hmm. you know, because philosopher, it's fine for philosophers to tell us this is a category and we should stop reproducing it in our work and our thought, but you know, most people don't care. They, you know, they think they it's not disappearing in that wider debate.
So you think nature might be a useful category still?
I really do, yeah. I mean, but the problem is when you start to think about that, it is problematic because you don't, one doesn't want, I certainly don't want to end up taking the position of the idea that you find in some parts of the kind of biological sciences maybe, or the environmental sciences, that there's some intrinsic human love for nature that can be exploited to bring about a better social future. I mean, this is just clearly nonsense, right? I mean, if that was the case, it's been there since the Romantics and it's not doing anything useful for us. So I think that's problematic, and I don't want to end up in that camp at all. But I you know, especially in Britain, right, where we see particularly visual spectacles of nature, and nature documentaries, which, you know, anybody educated can tell you are the most elaborate spectacles of natural beauty, of mediated beauty, but they remain a kind of really compelling space in which it's possible to start having different kinds of conversations about post-human, or, you know, about ways of thinking about the future that wouldn't necessarily centralize certain kinds of human well-being, but without having to couch it in that incredibly elaborate and esoteric language, academic language. So I do think there are possibilities there. I haven't myself, you know, done the work, done the spade work, the legwork to work out what it is, but I hope people do. And I think the nearest I've got to that is, I guess, I suppose I work quite a lot with speculative fiction. But even there, the speculative fiction that I choose to work with is not necessarily the most commercial or the most, you know, it's quite academically informed speculative fiction. But I do think those are spaces that can work on, again, quite esoteric and academic concerns and concepts in ways that are less self-serious and more accessible and more interesting and friendly to people, I hope.
What examples would you highlight of ecotopias in literature beyond Kallenbach?
So I started writing and thinking about this with three very specific texts in mind, and I think probably all three of them still bear. I think all of them are still readable and important, but they read differently now than they did when I started working with them. So one would be Marge Pierce's Woman on the Edge of Time, which is the well-known feminist utopia, but hadn't really been widely read, I think, as a green utopian fiction when I started working with it. And it imagines a kind of reconciliation of the human and the natural that's quite pastoral, which could be a little bit problematic in some ways. But she's got some really interesting things to tell us about bodily nature and about the relationship between culture and nature in that text, which are a bit clumsy, but are extremely well-meaning and I think quite prescient. So that would be one. The other writer that anyone in utopian studies would name next is Ursula K. Le Guin. I think Le Guin is now like our common cultural, do you think? Common cultural meeting point, especially with Dispossessed.
Yeah,
I regret not working with the Dispossessed a bit more in my own work. I haven't, partly just because it's been written about so much. Mm. Yeah, I don't know whether there's room to write anything interesting about it, but I was very entranced when I encountered that novel and Jameson's critical commentary on it about this notion of world reduction and the way that novel boils down notions of human sufficiency, satisfaction, desire, possibility, plausibility in the context of a very, very austere world. I found that really satisfying. But that's not the novel I've worked with most. The novel of Le Guin's that I've worked with most is called Always Coming Home, which is a huge, very stylistically rich and complex, multi-tiered, multi-textual, multi-voiced It's a kind of fictional cultural anthropology of a future society which is told in the past. All of it's like that. It kind of pushes and pulls you temporally, spatially, in all sorts of ways. It's a really fascinating, rich and rewarding novel, which doesn't quite break free of some of the problematic. It tries really hard, but I don't think ever quite gets past its own roots in a certain kind of anthropology that hasn't, an ethnography that hasn't fully come to terms with its colonial roots. So there's some, again, there's some kind of issues with that novel, but it is, it's very beautiful, and it has some really rich thinking in it. And then the novelist I've worked with most in relation to environmental utopianism, and the novelist I find most exciting and inspiring, and also increasingly frustrating of having to justify that, because, you know, very white American, middle-aged, I don't know how I justify this anymore. It's becoming increasingly frustrating for me, but it's Kim Stanley Robinson. Because there just isn't a single writer's oeuvre in the global north, and that's the culture I know, and that's the thinking I know best, which is not a justification, it's an explanation, really. But there isn't a single body of work that I know that has worked at and reworked at the question of what would a green utopia look like? What are the resources we have for imagining it? And how do we tell that story across narratives in ways that make it dramatically compelling? I mean, there is no body of work I know of so rich as that. So I worked a lot on what's sometimes called the Orange County Trilogy and sometimes called the Three Californias. I think it's retrospectively gained multiple names, but there's three novels he wrote in the 90s, late 80s and 90s, which imagine in three separate texts, three different futures for Orange County, California. So a kind of post-apocalyptic wilderness, a terrible post-industrial dystopia, and an authentically imagined green utopia, like a sustainable utopia. And that book's called Pacific Edge, and it remains, again, it's, you know, it's not a perfect novel by any means, but it's an exciting attempt to imagine in complex ways how you might legislate for decentralized, politically radically democratic, nature loving societies with a huge amount more social equality than we currently have. And the most recent bit of writing I've done is tried to compare that novel to, Robinson's more recent work. So that novel's really fascinating because it's a very regional, locally scaled vision of a different kind of social future. And that was how ecological philosophy from the 1960s to the 1990s or thereabouts, I would say, in the global north, that was the main motif of imagining a satisfying, green, sustainable ecotopia. Was you had to think about smaller scaling community down, you had to think about living in place, you had to think about decentralizing power. It was all very much about embedding, I think might be a useful way of thinking about it, how people could be embedded culturally and physically in certain kinds of ecosystems. And yeah, that seemed to be a really productive and generative way of thinking about what a more environmental future might look like. And the massive shift to me, you know, as we move towards an Anthropocene framing or a Capitalocene framing or a Pleistocene framing, however you kind of want to put this, and in the post-climate, in the midst of climate crisis, is the kind of absolute explosion of scale, temporal scale, geographical scale, social scale, through which we now have to think about that crisis. Morton was right. I don't like that he was right particularly, because it means that novels that I love feel less relevant than they ought to, but he's right. We can't imagine an alternative to an extractive, colonial, oppressive capitalism that is transforming the planet by imagining retreating into small communities. Oh, not only that, right? That's part of it, but not only that. So the novels I'm kind of trying to read at the moment are much more about trying to tackle the scale of the Anthropocene and the climate crisis through the scale of the Anthropocene. I mean, a lot of that work has already been done by Ursula Heiser, who's a really, really good reader of Kim Stanley Robinson on this stuff, I think. And I've been learning about a lot of this through her work. She isn't explicitly focused on the utopian part of it. And I think that is what you get from Robinson as a novelist, that he has been relentlessly committed to the changing possibilities of ecotopianism, green utopianism, repeatedly resituating it, you know, in the changing and increasingly hostile kind of social and cultural and environmental circumstances that we find ourselves in. He just will not let go of it. And I think it's just that sheer kind of doggedness of, like, you know, his line now is that ecotopia used to be a kind of escapist, you know, resistant but escapist cultural niche where overeducated people could ponder about what nicer worlds might look and feel like, and is now an absolute global cultural necessity, because otherwise, you know, it's very hard to imagine how you don't simply give in to the kind of death machine that we live in, and it's not a comfortable thought. But the fact that he can live with, you know, a large lump of nihilism but also keep imagining something a bit better is, I find, really helpful. And I think also what I increasingly like about his work is its acknowledgement of the need to think about ecotopia in pockets and strands and pieces rather than as a single kind of transformational reality. And that's helpful. And then that's the sense in which, for me, he's the most kind of sociological of novelists. Mm-hmm. You know, because for me, there is this tendency in some political takes on utopia, and that includes in novels as well as in political philosophy, to imagine the possibility of wholesale transformation. I don't just mean imagine as in want, I mean, you know, imagine as in feasible. And I think if the sociological imagination does anything, it's to sort of refuse that possibility of totalizing. Mm. You know, well, for me, all sociology is a kind of yes and on the, but this also, and social life is complicated. You know, so I think there's a sort of inbuilt necessity to think about the impossibility of any kind of totalizing change, which is problematic but also helpful. Anyway, so I think, you know, those are examples I would talk about. I think increasingly I've been trying to think about the eco-utopianism, not just in generically formal utopias, so not just in novels that call themselves a utopia, but in genres that are a bit weirder. So I've done a bit of work on Annihilation as having a kind of utopian element to it, some of N.K. Jemisin's work, not the Broken Earth trilogy, which I know a lot of people are, you know, really keen to think about as a sort of Anthropocene proto-utopia, but her new series, The City We Became, and its sequels, I've written a bit about that, as having a kind of brilliant utopian energy to it. Weirdly, and in terms of being a bit more populist and reaching a bigger audience, I'm really intrigued by Becky Chambers' work. So she writes these kinds of off-planet and far future science fiction, speculative fiction novels that are not utopian in their description of the society, but are deeply utopian in the sense that they are absolutely insistent on the possibility and necessity of imagining a world kind of restructured around care across different kinds of entities and being. I strongly recommend them. Monk and Robot series. I really like them. But they're not, you know, they're not, this is a kind of green utopianism now that is a million miles away from those novels that I first looked at, which were visibly shaped by certain kinds of radical eco-philosophy. Right, so I think you can read Pierce's Woman on the Edge of Time as being an attempt to articulate a kind of Murray Bookchin-esque, mm-hmm, and I think in law social ecology, you can see the deep influence of certain kinds of deep ecology and radical eco-philosophy in the work of Le Guin and Robinson. I mean, it might not be explicit, and I don't know what they say about their own influences, but those are novels that are deeply shaped by those ideas. The exciting thing and the slightly unnerving thing about green utopias, ecotopias in the early 20th century, 21st century, oh God, I've lost 100 years, in the early 21st century is that they don't run on those models. They just don't. There's not a kind of underpinning set of principles taken from eco-philosophy. They're just out there trying to figure it out, I think. And that's really weird and exciting, I think. But you know, when I was finished writing my book in the mid-2015, 2016 or something, and I was saying, oh, you know, you can't really write a fully blown utopian fiction anymore about a better, more sustainable world. It's just not possible. The climate crisis is too imminent. The future's been colonized by like the stuff that I know you want to talk about and think about in this special issue. And that has been really important to me, to understand how like moderate policy frameworks around sustainable development, adaptation, mitigation, you know, small tweaks in kind of industrial capitalism can save this. You know, the future has been so massively colonized by those ideas that there just isn't space to think any differently. And I remember giving a talk on this, and some woman at the back of the auditorium putting her hand up and going, have you heard of solar punk? And I was like, sort of. But you know, the minute you say something can't happen anymore, it's almost as if that's like the minute you realize you've been an idiot, because of course somebody somewhere has picked up this brilliant idea and reinvented it. Which I should have known, because I don't see utopias as the exclusive preserve of philosophers or, you know, novelists or whatever. That animating thread of like, no, this is terrible, we don't have to live with these rubbish futures, you know, is of course going to get picked up by some solar punk writer somewhere who's going to do a short story and design a vision of a kind of amazing techno eco future that's going to be, you know, look completely different to anything I've ever imagined, and reinvent it and reboot it. So I don't have any doubts or concerns about the capacity of a kind of eco utopian imaginary and imagination to keep reinventing itself. Mm-hmm. But that's the part of utopia that I prefer to deal with, right? And you know that in utopian studies as a field, that is seen as being either a precursor to or a kind of seedbed for a more transformative and willed utopianism. Mm-hmm. And that is really, really important.
And what's
but
other...
I insist on the need for the kind of fantastical and uncommitted utopianism.
Sorry, can you repeat, sorry?
Yeah, I think sometimes that insistence in utopian studies that the only utopia that matters is educated desire or will transformation or the kind of effortful political program that goes with it can sometimes devalue a little bit the fantastical and creative and free-floating and a bit uncommitted utopianism that I'm really interested in. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to defend fantastical utopianism as an end in itself. It clearly isn't. But I don't think people in society, you know, it doesn't matter how many times utopian studies theorists shake their heads and go, yes, but that doesn't turn into a political program. Who's listening? You know, you've got to kind of think about and work with the kind of, you know, the kind of, it's not spontaneous exactly, but the kind of, you know, untutored utopian possibilities that are constantly bubbling up, I think. Mm-hmm. But there's also, I also feel like it's a slight weakness in me. It's like intellectual weakness in me that I'm like, yeah, this is the fun part, you know, the kind of fantastical, playful part. Other people can worry about the actual radical transformation. I'm not very good at that. I don't like doing that, but it's sort of true.
Well, I think utopia has this kind of a fun part embedded in it. That's why it's utopian. It's not just political theory or other kinds of forms of thinking. So I guess it's like the balance between the two.
Yeah, it is a balance. And before you ask me the next question, I mean, I will say that in my field, you know, really important intervention in sociology with Eric Carly Wright's book on real utopias about 10, 15 years ago now, so I think it was 2010. And that is the work that in sociology a lot of people are really familiar with, American Sociology on Utopia. But it is really, it's really hard to criticize because, I mean, why on earth would I be sitting around criticizing a brilliant political, social political theorist who has traced like really important radical experiments in social democracy and socialism? It's amazing political theory, but he's terrible on utopia because, you know, he's only interested in, it's the definition of utopia that excludes all the creativity. So, you know, a thing can only be utopian really if it's a real utopia, if it's stripped of all of that kind of escapism and fantastical ideas and is turned into a political program. And that's fine. That's the most important thing, but it's not utopia at that point. It's a political program at that point, you know, and I think it's important to maintain that nuance in your thinking and that need for the creative and the critical, the kind of the playful and the pragmatic to kind of have that full range to play in any functional notion of utopia.
And if we take the playful to the actual sphere of life, this playful dimension of utopia, what examples would you highlight in social practice, like real utopianism or utopian practice?
It's a good one, I think. I mean, I probably, for a sociologist, I've been really, really good at reading books and not really very good at social practice. And I draw a lot of inspiration from theorists who are not sociologists, who are really, really good at utopia and social practice. The Davina Cooper's book, Everyday Utopias, to me has been, you know, in recent times one of the most important interventions into what utopia as social practice might look like. Finding it in bathhouses and naked cycle rides and speaker's corner, but you know, lots of these unexpected spaces and places where, as she would argue, I think that moment of kind of playful intervention is a way of playing with concepts in a public, you know, stretching concepts and stretching practice at the same time. So I find that really, 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 really important. I think it's not my specific research field really, but I teach a module most years. I'm having a rest at Newcastle, but I do teach a module called Society in the Utopian Imagination that tries to kind of comprehensive wouldn't even begin to cover it, but does try to kind of, the whole logic of that module is to try and alert students to the presence of like that playful utopian practice in a multitude of spheres of social life. So I think they always imagine it will only ever be things like intentional communities and highly organized political movements, but I think, you know, we can see small moments of resistance as being really important in that. And I'm struggling to think of any examples right now. Maybe it'll come to me when we talk a bit more. But, you know, I think, you know, that capacity to kind of just have those moments of refusal and moments of dreaming in kind of everyday life are just so vitally important. And Mike Gardner's work's been really important for me in that thinking as well. So that would, and there's something in his work as well, I think, that you probably would understand better than me, which is the link between a kind of artistic imagination, particularly visually artistic imagination, and thinking about vision, you know, making appear to be present possibility of alternatives in the moment. So he traces a lot of that thought through situationists and surreal, you know, so there's a kind of, for him, there's a long tradition.
Who are you talking about? No. Sorry?
Mike Gardner. Do you know his stuff?
No.
Mike Gardner. Oh, okay. But he tries to trace a kind of notion of everyday utopianism through, not directly, empirically, but through social theory that has space for the contestatory elements of everyday life in it. So, I mean, the theorist won't be that unexpected, I guess, to many people, Bakhtin and De Certo and Lefebvre, but he writes a lot about you know, the kind of self-theorizing art movements that also did a lot of that work. There's a chapter on situationism, I think, and one on surrealists. So he's really he's a really interesting thinker. Then I've not really answered your question. I'm struggling to be inspiring about that. I have to think about it. Actual examples of utopian play. Really nice.
And you've been working on on green utopianism for a while and ecological utopianism. How has the reception of this work been, and how has it evolved?
Oh, that's a good question. That's a really good question. I don't know about the reception really, because it doesn't feel like you do your thing, and I think if you're saying, kind of ignore what people say about it really. I don't know, but I think probably two or three things I've noticed. I think there was a I think I'm really struggling to answer this one. I'll start with my own discipline, where I think when I started doing this work, even outside of the realm of science and technology studies, it was quite rare to see much work in sociology on environmental issues, and that has fundamentally changed. So that's good. I think it's possible now to think to work with the notion of utopia in academic social theory in a way that, I don't know, maybe was possible historically and then disappeared for a while. I'm really struggling to answer that. My feeling is that, you know, we've probably reached a point politically, culturally, academically, where any and all possible doors that might shift the nothing, kind of the utter failure of kind of policy and practical responses to the climate crisis is has to be welcome. And I think, so it feels like the territory in which ideas about green utopianism now play is a bit more open. I think when I started doing this work, it was fine to think about green utopias, but only in certain intellectual contexts. So critical theory, certain parts of the literary humanities, I think, were quite welcoming. But generally speaking, in mainstream debates, in the social sciences in particular, you had to be quite carefully translate what utopia was and what it may do to make it palatable to those kinds of discussions. And I don't think that's necessary anymore. I think it's okay to say, are you kidding me? You know, are you honestly saying after this like 20-year old pass of doing, you know, where moderate reforming approaches have done absolutely nothing, that we now are just saying all radical kind of responses are off the table? I think there's room for those kinds of debates in a better way. I also think I think this generation of young I mean, this is where I feel about 163, but you know, this generation of young people are expecting us to be able to meet them on this ground. I think not all of them, not all the time, but we are supposed to have a conversation with 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds who have been self-educated in the language of, you know, Extinction Rebellion, and who have taken, you know, my generation's utter failure. It's problematic to think of it in generational terms. It's not the answer, but it is a question, right? Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah.
I have literally sat in supervisions with like 20-year-olds going, so how do you help your generation, you know, how do you help your generation's utter failure to make my generation okay? And you're like, well, you know, I'm sorry I personally failed you in this. I can't, you know, it's a bit of a stupid, it's not an answer to talk in generational terms, but they are quite rightly asking that generational question. Like, how are we supposed to deal with this? And what are you going to give us to help us deal with this? And I hear that in my students, and I think there's an openness to using those, like using radical ideas, more than even 10 years, 5 years ago there was. I think it's just that I think it's a responsibility, really. But I also think one of the things I feel more compelled to do when I talk about ecotopia now, this is a really elaborate way of answering the question, Julia. I'm really sorry, but I have had to go around a million houses to get, I've had to go a long way to get to this kind of answer. But I think I felt like 20 or 30 years ago, not that old, but like 20 years ago, I could just say, look, you know, we need to think in utopian terms about genuine alternatives to the possibilities for a good life that this world now gives us. And that could be in the future. And that's good for all of us, right? That would have been what I would have said. Now, I don't think any of us, especially my generation, should be allowed to think about utopia without also thinking about failure and complicity. And do you see what I mean? So I think, I feel like I've lived through, more or less, and I've worked through and researched through the shift of the climate horizon from something that's a threat that should change our behavior in the present to something that we are fully living through. And the future becomes less useful to us as a resource for thinking about alternatives. And we also have to accept that as we continue to live a depleting, extractive, and wasteful life, and I do, and I, you know, most of my friends and family do, through this knowledge, we have to start somewhere else with those arguments. But those arguments have to start with, you know, we are in varying ways stuck in these problematic ways of living, and we are choosing to reproduce them. We have to start thinking about alternatives from a different kind of place. And I don't know how much for me that's like the personal guilt of not knowing this stuff 20 years ago and not going to live in an eco commune, which I didn't do. Mm-hmm. And how much of it is that sense that climate failure is, we just have to own it. All of us have to own it in some small way. Some of us have to own it in huge ways. You know, I mean, I'm not a politician, I don't run BP, I'm not taking responsibility for that. But I think I've noticed in the last 10 or 20 years that when you think about environmental utopianism, green utopianism, and better futures, there has been a slight polarization whereby there are very strong voices saying the time for sort of individual change and transformation is over. This is the end of capitalism or bust. You know, this has got to be a gigantic revolutionary shift. There is therefore no point feeling guilty about your own failures and complicity, because how could we be any different? So that's one kind of strand of it, a kind of radical take on where that utopianism has to come from, sort of from outside our own imbrication in it. And then the other side of it, this kind of modest, pragmatic, better sustainable futures line. I'm working with a few people at the moment who are doing work on environmental education, for example, and I think it's quite prevalent there, is more like, okay, everybody, you know, let's just think a little bit about how we could be more sustainable and not have a climate crisis. So how could we make small changes, and how can we all make our contribution? But I feel like those two pieces have now become wildly separated in the way we think about environment and climate futures and crisis. And neither of them is all that satisfying. And I need to figure out, I want to find a way of operating in between them with a functioning notion of ecotopia that is that doesn't deny that we're trapped in a kind of gigantic structural situation, not of most of our making, but that doesn't equally insist that there's no point me not flying or doing this or changing that because, you know, big oil will never change. You know, that's not a satisfactory moral or imaginative response to the situation we find ourselves in. And on the other side, you know, the small changes, adaptation, shuffling towards hopefully, you know, building a next generation who will make the changes is also, you know, clearly lacks any kind of like imaginative responsibility, I think. So I find myself spending quite a lot of time about how we recast the utopianism in the context of it, clearly, you know, in the context of Global North people, right? I mean, I'm not spreading this responsibility any further than it needs to be. And it is definitely needs to be nuanced, and we all need to carry it in different ways depending on our social positioning. And many of us have very few choices and responsibilities to take in this. But enough of us are kind of in the middle where we could do something, but we don't. And it shouldn't be up to us, but it kind of is. You know, that I think, you know, trying to find a way of thinking utopia through a kind of wider notion of failure and complicity. So that's the big thing. I mean, I would have said, if you'd asked me this like 10 years ago, I would have said the big shift since I started writing about green utopias was it has been that it used to be that environmental utopianism was about how do we save nature? And if we save nature, will we be happier? Yes, as people. That was kind of, you know, the core of it. And now that's not it. It just isn't, you know, there isn't. And that it's fruitless to think about saving nature. Mm. Intellectually, it might be useful to leverage the currents that want to do that, like in everyday life, but it's not a useful intellectual position today. But, you know, a lot of thinkers want to argue that, you know, letting go of saving nature is a utopian moment, right? It's not about holding on to something or conserving something or living according to something's natural laws. It's much more like, what do we want? Who do we want to be? What kinds of ways of living alongside this lively world are better for everyone? And it is liberating to think about that intellectually, but it's politically deeply frustrating as well.
Do you see a growing interest in ecotopias?
Yes and no. Yeah, I think there is a sense that people, you know, I mean, and some of it is really superficial, right? It is just like, I cannot read another dystopian novel. I cannot look at another bleak vision of, you know, Earth in 20 or 25 years time. There has to be a space where there's a more hopeful and positive engagement with how this might all turn out. So yeah, from that point of view, and I do, you know, I think yeah, I think that's true. I think in public discourse, I think Kim Stanley Robinson is sort of right in that there has to be a radical alternative because business as usual is entirely unviable. And I think the response to his Ministry of the Future was really interesting. You know, I feel like that was a kind of opening up to the way in which he made that intervention that was positive in some ways. And I think there is an appetite for some, you know, younger people to really open up those spaces and insist on the possibility of something better. All of that's really important. So yes. but, you know, I think we need to do more, those of us that are interested in like what the imagination can do and what alternative imaginaries can do. And this has always been the case for me in utopia and utopian studies, need to do more and do better to show what kinds of change is possible without being reductive. So it's a core tenet of utopian studies, right? That I think, tell me if you think I've got this wrong, that the function of utopia isn't to function as a plan for the building of a total alternative. It's to educate and stimulate the desire for something different. But, you know, how, for who, where, when, you know, there's a kind of absolutely absent empirical base to that. And that's fair enough because it's very hard to operationalize those kinds of philosophical claims without the thing itself kind of slipping away and being crushed and reduced to something silly and measurable, and nobody in the field wants that, I don't think. But I do think we need to do a better job if we're serious, if we seriously think ecotopia can intervene and not just be a kind of cultural commentary on what's happening to us. And if that's what it is, that's fine. I'm all right with that. You know, it might just be a cultural commentary on, you know, fundamental turning point of global civilization or whatever. But if it's not going to be just that, if we want to make different and bigger claims about what ecotopia is, we need to do better to understand how it can affect people and its effects. Because I think it is fundamentally about understanding it as a, in terms of desire, rather than just as an epistemological intervention.
I know you have been called by policy planners. How were those meetings and how was Ecotopia mobilized within those meetings?
Not really. I think I haven't had serious discussions with policy people. I have had kind of conversations in the interstices of conferences and things like that. And this is going back quite a long time now. To ask about what utopia could do more instrumentally, and I'm, you know, I want us to be able to claim it and use it and own it, but not at the expense of being reductive about it. So I think there's this tendency. So this isn't from my personal experience, but to take one example, if you look at a lot of the ways in which green futures are framed in IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports, and related UN type documents, you will tend to find the label ecotopia or whatever attached to the most optimistic or the sunniest version of a numerous terrible futures. And that's unhelpful, right? Because it suggests that we could pick from all these options and we should pick this one, but we're probably not picking that one. It's not, who's choosing? That's not helpful. I think for me, and this might be interesting to talk to someone who about the visual dynamics of utopia, right? So you could probably tell me more than I can tell you about this. But okay, let me try and get back to that point. There's something about the complex function of a utopian narrative, a long utopian narrative, that is particularly special for me. And I don't By that, I don't mean it's the best way of doing utopia. I just mean I am, by constitution, a novel reader, I think. If I think about what made me as a thinker, it's more than anything a long, long, long history, from very young, of reading novel length and often quite speculative fiction. So for me, those kinds of texts can do a number on you that is uniquely interesting, because it not only can sketch what Tom Moylan in his book Critical Utopias calls the iconic register of some, it gives you some vision, some substantive vision of what an alternative greener society might look like, but because of the way reading works, because it invites us to be empathetic and affected and to get involved emotionally in complicated human and social lives, it gives us the impression that we might get a glimpse of what it might feel like to live differently. So when policy makers think that they can use utopia to kind of persuade people to recycle, by reducing a novel to like a 2-page scenario, you just think, oh, I think you might have misunderstood how this works. A vague description of what a future society might be like is not in itself persuasive in a policy context. It might be, but persuasion and desire are so much richer and more complicated than that, aren't they? I mean, if you say, oh, everyone will live in a nice house and they'll have a there'll be no dependency on fossil fuels and their lives will be simpler, but it will be fine. All right, maybe. But I think there's something about the narrative form that for me is like it invites you to imaginatively experience a different kind of life. Yeah, that you could just argue that's just a feature of the novel. The social realist novel does that to an extent, you know, it just invites you to kind of imaginatively experience someone else's consciousness, a modernist novel, someone else's consciousness, or, you know, someone else's social reality. I read a lot of George Eliot, you know, I spend a lot of time imagining that I live in the middle of the 19th century wearing a corset, I don't know, I mean, but, you know, the speculative novel explicitly ties that functionality of the novel to a few, you know, a genuine social political alternative. That's why Le Guin's such a big part of utopian studies, I think, because she affects that. She pulls those two things together in an enormously innovative and compelling way. Like, things might be different, and you might feel like, here's how you might feel, and she can reach you on those two levels in that way. That's really, really exciting. So I think I'm very, very. There's new, I mean, there are, you'll know as well as anyone, that there are numerous ways of being skeptical of the potential for utopia to be instrumentalized. And I mean instrumentalized, not as opposed to commodified or commercialized. We can come back to that as well, because that's related, but it's separate. There is something about policy making and the instrumental end of social science that is unavoidable in large complex societies, but that often wants to take a really, really complicated, multifaceted, rich social phenomenon and use it to nudge, or to, you know, to produce some sort of behavioristic effect, and that's silly, and we really need to resist utopia, I think, being caught up in that. I am equally concerned that utopia, green utopias, ecotopias, are always and only ever associated with really radical forms of social practice. They are associated with really radical forms of social practice, and that is incredibly important, like in resistance and protest movements, in intentional communities, in quite loose, you know, protest, and you know much more about that than I do. But that's not they are not the exclusive owners and operators of utopia. Do you know what I mean? They're one really rich and important part of how we have to understand how utopia genuinely does get translated into social practice. And that's really exciting. But we also need to understand that in a really careful way that doesn't suggest that the only thing utopia can do is be attached to a radical program. Because it must do that, but it needs to do lots of, it can do lots of other things as well. And you alienate a lot of people, I think, if you argue that's the exclusive, you know, the only domain in which utopia can operate is in self-identified radical alternatives. Does that make sense?
Yes. So then what agency, or in what ways do you consider the agency of ecotopias within strategic responses to the eco-social crisis?
I wish I could answer that. It would be a kind of claim to a sort of expertise that I don't have. I feel as, like, you know, generally it's kind of despairing as anybody, really. I just don't think existentially there's any choice but to insist that utopias have to have room to be agential. Does that make
sense?
Sorry,
I didn't understand that. Sorry.
Well, how do you, you know, even though I'm a sociologist, which is a, you know, a discipline concerned with social actions and social dynamics, I don't think I have any special insight into what ecotopias can do. I just kind of have to believe that it is better to have politically radical and playful and compelling visions of alternatives in the mix of the debate in the wider society, because otherwise it will be so much poorer that I can't contemplate, you know, what I don't want to live in that world where there's not the possibility of having that expression. But I, other than to have a kind of vague sense that utopia is a social thing and that it forms part of the kind of complex mesh networks and assemblages through which action happens. And I do think that's true. I think utopia is as likely to happen to us as we are to think it or to make it, I think. So from that point of view, the argument might be that you need to proliferate it so that it's more amplified and more present and more resonant in across a range of networks, in which things get done and things happen. But I don't have any, I'm embarrassed to admit really, I mean, I just don't have any kind of specialist knowledge or skill that would allow me to make a strong claim that Ecotopia, about how Ecotopian agency could be amplified. I'd like to know. I think it's worth spending time on, because I think too much of the ways in which utopia and ecotopia have been picked up in the social sciences in the last 10 or 15 years has been just to say, we need more utopian visions. Yeah, we do. And then, you know what? You know, there's been so little engagement with how they move, how they reach people, what people do with them. And I think that is a genuine area where research could be, like a fairly systematic but non-reductive research could be really helpful.
Thank you so much, Lisa. I think that's kind of a really nice ending. And thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure. It's been really interesting. I'm going to stop the recording.